good news is that we're living at this time of incredible advance in these fields of studying the mind. And when Freud wrote about the unconscious many decades ago, it had a pervasive effect on the culture. Now I think researchers are giving us a more accurate view of the unconscious, and I think it will have a pervasive and extremely positive view on our culture and our policy for decades to come.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm George Gillum. I bring what I know for some of you, if not many of you in this room, will consider very, very bad news. Our guest today, David Brooks, is not, and I repeat for emphasis, not running for president. Even worse, he can't. The birthers will see to that. David Brooks was actually born in Canada. David was raised in New York City and on the main line outside of Philadelphia, and graduated from the University of Chicago with a degree in history. In 1983, the year he graduated from Chicago, he wrote a parody of William F. Buckley, Jr., which included lines like, "In the afternoons, he's in the habit of going into crowded rooms and making everybody else feel inferior." And that line appears in slightly different context in the new book. Buckley loved the piece and offered Brooks a job at National Review. And since that time, David Brooks has written for the Washington Times, for the Wall Street Journal, the Atlantic Monthly, and the Weekly Standard. For the past several years, he's provided a conservative voice as a columnist for the New York Times and as a commentator on the PBS NewsHour. Of David Brooks' four books, two are cultural commentary, Bobos in Paradise, The New Upper Class and How They Got There, and On Paradise Drive, How We Live Now and Always Have in the Future Tense. His most recent and most ambitious book synthesizes several hundred studies, I think I lost count at about 200, published by psychologists, sociologists, anthropologists, and others. The Social Animal, The Hidden Source of Love, Character, and Achievement, presently number 3 on the nonfiction bestseller list. Please welcome David Brooks.
My cover story is that I was born in Canada. I was actually born in Kenya. At least I'm man enough to admit it, unlike Barack Obama. It's a great pleasure to be back at the Miller Center. I've been here several times, and I know Miller Center audiences quite well. And knowing that, I'll try to be brief. I know you didn't come here to hear me speak. You came here to hear yourself speak. And so I'll try to... I'll try to get out of the way of the soliloquies that are to come. Actually, the last time I came to the Miller Center, I was very honored to give a speech on the lawn of Monticello, and I was asked to give a speech about my political hero, not Thomas Jefferson, but Alexander Hamilton. And my speech was, and Governor and George can confirm this, was interrupted by lightning. And so TJ, as we call him, was upset by the kind words I had for Alexander Hamilton, but it's Hamilton's country, not Jefferson's. Though as it occurs to me, it's Jefferson's Republican Party and not Hamilton. So, and also, it's a great pleasure to be at an institution so deeply interwoven with PBS and the NewsHour. One of the things you learn on book tour is to appreciate the NewsHour, because you often do shows when you're on book tour where you're wishing the earth would swallow you up whole, and that never happens at the NewsHour. It's just a great pleasure to be on with my friend Mark Shields. Some of you know Mark has been doing this show for quite a little while now. Our segment is called Shields and Brooks. We wanted to call it Brooks Shields. We thought it'd sell better, but And before that, it was Shields and Gigot. Before that, it was Shields and Gergen. Before that, it was Shields and Coolidge. It started out as Shields and Thomas Aquinas, I think. And so he's been doing it a little while, but it's a great pleasure always to do shows with him, and it's a tremendous honor to do something with Lehrer. I keep a list of the five people in Washington that I really admire. Just when I get down, I like to have a list of five people who are just tremendously admirable, who I can say, well, at least these five people are here. And they include people like Michelle Bachmann, and no, I'm just kidding. I have a list of a couple regulars on that list. George Shultz, who some of you may know, was a really fine public servant, is on that list. Lehrer is on that list. Bob Gates, I think, now Secretary of Defense, is on the list. There are a couple others cycled through. But for these people, it's always about doing the job. It's not about themselves. And that's what I think what Lehrer exemplifies. And then finally, it's a great honor, especially at the end of this book, to be at UVA, because the description, the intellectual advance that I really describe at this book, in this book, really began, if it began anywhere, it began in many ways at UVA. A series of very important researchers, for example, Timothy Wilson, Jonathan Haidt, Eric Turkheimer are here at UVA, and they really were, I've learned so much from reading them. And really, they were three of the people very instrumental to sending me off on this reporting binge that I've been on. I didn't get to it intellectually, though. I got to it through politics. As some of you know, I have a column at the New York Times. I'm the conservative columnist at the Times, which I liken to being chief rabbi at Mecca. not always a lot of company there, but. And when I got my current job, I was given a good piece of advice by Robert Novak, which was to interview three politicians every day. And if you spend as much time around politicians, you know, as I do, present company accepted, they're all emotional freaks of one sort or another. They have what I call logorrhea dementia, which is they talk so much they drive themselves insane. But what they do have is incredible social skills. And so when you get with politicians in a group, especially, they just want to connect with people. We need food and water. They need people. And so they stand too close to you. They grab you by the lapels. They invade your personal space. They'll caress your cheek. They'll rub the back of your hair. Years ago, I was up in the Senate Press Gallery, and I'm looking down the Senate, and Dan Quayle is meeting Ted Kennedy at the well of the Senate. And I guess they were friends, and they gave each other a big hug. And their faces were like this far apart, and they were laughing, and they stayed hugging, and their arms were moving up and down each other's backs, and they were moving and sort of grinding away down there. And I was like, get a room. I don't want to see this. But that's the sort of physical and social contact they need. The story I tell about Bill Clinton, which you'll call name-dropping, but I call reporting, is that Clinton's coming out of a hotel elevator in Boston. I happen to be walking through the lobby. Sees me, starts praising me for a column I had written praising him, which he thought was particularly brilliant. And so he's talking to me, and then a crowd gathers when they see Bill Clinton in the lobby, and he wants to embrace the crowd. And so he starts backing up so they can all hear his words. And within a few minutes, he's like 80 feet away from me, way over there, just talking to me, but embracing the whole group. And they all had a personal Clinton experience. And that's sort of just a social skill they have. Mitt Romney, last time I was up, he was running for president. He was up in New Hampshire. I was covering him. He was up there campaigning one day with his five perfect sons, Bip, Chip, Rip, Sip, Dip, Lip, and Skip. He goes into a diner, and he introduces himself to each family at the diner, asks them what village in New Hampshire are you from, and then he would describe the home he owned in their village, and he went around the whole room, and he's on his way out, and he's met like 30 or 40 people, and he first names almost everybody he's just met. I thought, okay, this is a profession I won't be going into. And just finally, a couple weeks ago, I was at the National Institutes of Health near where I live in Bethesda, Maryland, and a neuroscientist shows me a video of a girl with Williams syndrome. And Williams syndrome from the outside looks like reverse autism. And so the girl who's only 18 months, she only has interest in social signals. And in the video, she's in a room with a 12-year-old boy, the researcher's son, and he's juggling and knocking over stuff, trying to get her interested in the physical objects in the room. And she just has no interest in it. She just stands too close to him and just stares into his eyes, wanting social signals. And I'm looking at this video and I'm thinking, this is every senator I've ever covered that they have. And so what I'm sort of describing here is people with incredibly deft social skills. And when I cover them in their official duties, all that subtlety goes away. When they're campaigning, often it's rehashed, rehearsed, and very crude emotionalism that they exhibit. And then when they govern, often they take a very dehumanized view of nature, of human nature, where all the social antennae that gets tossed out the window and they start thinking like CBO reports. And so I've covered a series of policy failures over the course of my career, all of which derive from the fact that we sometimes, when we govern, have an overly simplistic view of human nature. And so I covered the decline of the Soviet Union, the rise of Russia, and we sent economists into Russia and Ukraine and places like that under the supposition that all problems are essentially economic problems, and they needed hard currency plans and privatization plans. But what they lacked in Russia and Ukraine and places like that were social trust. And as a result, they essentially stole everything, and the countries were plundered. But we were sort of blind to that because we didn't know how to measure social trust. Then I covered the war in Iraq, and we sent the military trying to change the nation of Iraq, and we were oblivious, at least our leaders were, to the psychological and cultural realities to Iraq, in Iraq. The World Value Survey, when they got in there, they asked people in Iraq, would you mind if a foreigner moved next door? In the US, if you ask that question, 9% of Americans say they would mind if a foreigner moved next door. Globally, the global average is 16%. In Iraq, when they asked that question, the answer was 91% would mind. So it would have been helpful to know that. And I once asked a senior member of the Bush administration, didn't you guys kind of get the culture of Iraq wrong? And this person said, well, I don't really believe in culture. I think if you change the institutions, you change the society. And that is the correct political science answer. It doesn't happen to be the correct answer. And then we had a financial system based on the assumption that bankers are prudent, rational, self-interested creatures who would never do anything stupid en masse. And that turns out not to always be true. And then on school reform, which is the issue I care most about, I've been covering education reform since 1983 with the Nation Risk Report. And we've had a whole series of education reform initiatives which have yielded disappointing results because we've skirted the core issue, which is the individual relationship between a teacher and a student. And so we've spent a lot of time rearranging the bureaucratic boxes of big schools and little schools, vouchers, charters, all that stuff. And yet the reality is people learn from people they love. And if you mention the word love at a congressional hearing, they look at you like Oprah. It's not the language we're used to talking about. And so you've had this whole series of failures, this weird phenomenon where the most socially attuned people on earth become completely dehumanized when they think about policy. And so I was thinking about this, and I came to the conclusion that this is not only a policy problem, it's a wider cultural problem. And so for centuries, we've inherited a view of ourselves that we're divided creatures, that we have reason over here and emotion over here. And sometimes they're at war, sometimes it's like a seesaw. If reason is up, then emotion is down, and if emotion is up, then reason is down. And it's led to a view of human nature that we're rational individuals who respond in straightforward ways to incentives, which is sort of the homo economicus view of human nature. It's led to ways of analyzing the world that prevail in a lot of academic disciplines, where we think we can study human beings according to the methodologies of physics, in which we emphasize all the things that can be counted and modeled with a computer model and amputate all the rest. And so I think we've had an amputation of the deepest part of ourselves, not only in policy, but in many different realms. And I think as a culture, we're really good at talking about material things, really bad at talking about emotions. We're good at talking about skills and safety, but we're often bad at talking, or at least inarticulate, when it comes to talking about things like character, which is the most important thing. Alistair MacIntyre, the great philosopher, said, "We have words like honor, virtue, vice, sin, but we no longer have a system to understand how they all fit together." He said, imagine having words like gravity, electron, neutron, but not having a theory of physics to know how they fit together. And he said that was the state of our culture. And so this influence, this amputation, really has an effect on policy and has an effect on child rearing. If you go to my neighborhood in Bethesda, Maryland, or if you go to the schools around here at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, the elementary school. You see little kids coming out of the elementary schools. They've got these 80-pound backpacks on their back. If the wind blows them over, they're like beetles sort of stuck there on the ground. And they get picked up by, usually in nice neighborhoods like this one, their luxury cars coming to pick them up, usually Audis and Saabs and Volvos, because in these neighborhoods it's socially acceptable to have a luxury car so long as it comes from a country hostile to U.S. foreign policy. That's okay. And so then these creatures I wrote about in one book come to pick them up, called Uber Moms, who are highly successful career women who've taken time off to make sure all their kids get into Harvard. And you can usually tell the Uber Moms because they actually weigh less than their own children. Sort of during little conception, they're doing little butt exercises to stay fit and trim, taking so many soy-based nutritional formulas that during when the babies come out, they're like these huge 13-pound behemoths, like toothless defensive linemen plopping out there. Uber Moms are cutting the umbilical cord themselves, adjusting the video lighting, flashing Mandarin flashcards at the things to get them ready for Harvard. And so this is the mode of child rearing that many of us ridicule but don't renounce. It's the tiger mom type thing where we drive our kids constantly, make them the junior workaholics of America, are really good at talking about getting good grades and SAT scores, the sort of things the admissions committee like, but ignoring or being inarticulate about the things that really matter. And the tiger mom was sort of an extreme example of that. She wrote a book about making sure her kids got A's and studied violin and piano, but she forbade them from going to sleepovers. And I wrote a column saying, if you really want to know what's cognitively demanding, a 14-year-old girl at a sleepover with a bunch of other 14-year-old girls, that is cognitively demanding. I don't say that from personal experience, but but that is the thing we sometimes deny. And then when we talk about morality, we are really good at talking about health and safety and things like that. But often when we talk about morality, I did a story from Princeton where I asked the professors, do you teach character here? And they said, well, we'd like them to develop character, but they're more or less on their own. We don't quite know what to say or what a theory of character is. So when we talk about morality, often we drift into shopping. And so we shop at Ben & Jerry's ice cream because it's a morally uplifting ice cream company, makes us feel good about ourselves. I once joked that Ben & Jerry's should make a pacifist toothpaste, doesn't kill germs, just ask them to leave. That would be a big seller. Or else, you know, we shop at the morally uplifting grocery stores like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's, all the organic grocery stores where all the cashiers look like they're on loan from Amnesty International, and you can get sort of morally uplifting snacks, usually made out of seaweed. What my house, we buy veggie booty with kale, which is for kids who come home and say, Mom, I want a snack that'll help prevent colon rectal cancer. And so this is the state we're in, a state where in the world of policy, in the world of child rearing, and then in the general culture of talking about what's really important, we know what's important, but we're sometimes inarticulate about it. And so I was dealing with these problems, and then I came across, in part because of people like Hayden Turkheimer and Wilson here at UVA, a group of researchers who were actually telling us about what's deepest in ourselves. And the odd thing is the fields of research doing this most aggressively and most assertively right now are not theology and philosophy, which are the people who usually tell us about who we are, but they're in people who study the human mind in a series of disciplines like neuroscience, cognitive science, psychology, sociology, behavioral economics. And they're really making tremendous and exciting strides in telling us who we are, really reminding us who we are. And the good news is even though they use the language of science, and often the technology like fMRI machines, the picture of ourselves they are painting is not a cold, deterministic picture. It's a rich, enchanted, and humanistic picture. And really it revives, I think, the emphasis on the humanities, even though they are scientists. It heals the rift between the two cultures. And the work they are doing is really congregates around three key insights. The first insight is while the conscious mind writes the autobiography of our species, most of our thinking is unconscious. And so one way to put it, which Wilson does in a book, a very fine book called Strangers to Ourselves, He says there are 11, the human mind, and this is mostly for illustration purposes, the human mind can take in about 11 million pieces of information, of which it can be roughly consciously aware of 40. Other researchers put it differently, that about 2% of our conscious, of our thinking is conscious. All the rest is unconscious. And in this realm of unconscious cognition, there are oddities. My favorite one, the somewhat controversial study by a guy at University of Buffalo that found that people named Dennis are disproportionately likely to become dentists. People named Lawrence are disproportionately likely to become lawyers, because unconsciously, even if slightly, we bias toward things that are familiar, which is why my own daughter is named President of the United States, Brooks. Another thing I think found by Dan Ariely, who's at Duke, was that when you eat alone, you eat this much. When you eat with one other person, you eat on average 35% more. When you eat with three other people, you eat on average 78% more. And these are things we're not really aware of, but it's some of the things going on down there. And the other thing that's interesting is that when that the unconscious, a lot of it is peculiar, a lot of it is weak, but in some ways it's particularly smart. And so Wilson here did a study where he gave people posters and said, choose a poster. And then he asked them how satisfied are you with the poster you choose? And the people who made a conscious list of which poster would be good were not as satisfied as the people who sort of studied it, absorbed it, abided with it, and then a few days later went with their intuition, went with their gut. And so in some ways the intuition is stupid, but in some ways it's phenomenally smart. And so if you, just because it has more processing power. And so one of the tips I got, if you're having trouble making a decision between two options, tell yourself you'll flip a coin, but don't go by whether it comes up heads or tails. Go by your emotional reaction to the coin flip. Are you happy or sad it came up heads or tails? And that'll tell you what your inner mind was actually thinking. And so that's the first foundational principle, the power of the unconscious. The second is that emotions are not separate from reason. Emotion is the foundation of reason. A scientist at USC named Antonio Damasio studies people who've had lesions and can't process emotion. So you show them a horrible picture, they know what they should think, feel, but they don't feel anything, because they can't process it. And these people are not super smart Mr. Spocks, they're super dumb. They make horrible decisions and lead self-destructing, downward spiraling lives. Because the emotions, one of the things they do is they tell us what we value, what we admire, what we want. They're like a GPS system giving us a signal, you want that, you don't want that, you admire that, you have contempt for that. And if you don't know what you want, you can make a rational decision, because your decision-making landscape is hopelessly flat. Now, I'm a middle-aged American guy. I'm not the most particularly astute at talking about emotions. My wife jokes that me writing a book about emotions is like Gandhi writing a book about gluttony. It's not my natural thing. There's an apocryphal brain research story, which is nonetheless profoundly true, where they took a bunch of middle-aged guys, put them in a brain scan machine, had them watch a horror movie, and then asked them to describe their feelings toward their wives. And the brain scans were the same in both activities. And I sort of get that. Nonetheless, emotion is central to how we think, because it tells us what to value. It's central to what we remember. Kids who have very unemotional childhoods often later in life can scarcely remember their childhoods, because emotion tells us what to remember. Emotion literally wires the fibers of the brain together. There's an orphanage in 1945 out west where they decided the way to raise healthy kids was to do it antiseptically. And so they gave them food, they gave them good health care, they did not touch the little babies. And the mortality rate by age 2 was 37%. And so these kids died at phenomenal rates. They stopped naming the kids because they were dying at such high rates. And so it's literally the emotion between a mother and a daughter, or a father and a son, or whatever, that literally wires the brain together. And the third insight is that we're not primarily self-contained individuals, the way Hobbes and others thought. We're social animals. We don't create relationships. We emerge out of relationships. And when we see each other, we are not observing each other. We are reenacting in our own minds the things we see. So when you see me pick up a bottle of water, your brain looks like you yourself are picking up a bottle of water. If you see me pick it up to drink, you react one way. If you see me pick it up to put it in the garbage can, you react another way. Not only are you reenacting what I'm doing, you're perceiving the intention behind the action and reenacting that. And so it's a deep interpenetrative process. When you watch a horror movie, your brain reacts like you were in a car chase, your brain reacts like you were in a car chase. And so these deep interpenetrations explain why you can have an emotional contagion sweep across, say, the Middle East or through the financial sectors, because we intuitively mimic and copy each other in a deep, profound way. And many of the modes of communication, some are visual, some are in ways we don't even think about, like smell. We sometimes are barely aware of our sense of smell, but people who lose the sense of smell suffer greater emotional deterioration than people who lose any other sense, because so much of our communication is by odor. So one experiment that illustrated this is in Germany, they took a bunch of people, taped gauze pads under their arms, had some of the people watch a horror movie, some of the people watch a comedy, and then they had other research subjects, presumably very well paid, sniff the gauze pads and said, what movie did this person watch? And people can tell it way above average chance what movie they watch just by sniffing. And women are much better at this than men. It'll not surprise you. So these are the three foundational principles, the tremendous power of unconscious processes, the centrality of emotion to reason, and the deep interpenetration between people. And when you see these things as they play out, you get a different story of who we are. In some ways, we, especially in academia, are children of the French Enlightenment that believe reason is the highest of the faculties, along with René Descartes. But this research really doubts that that's really who we are. It confirms the views of what you might call the Scottish or British Enlightenment, people like David Hume and Adam Smith, who said reason is important, but it's weak. Our sentiments are strong, and that our sentiments are often wise. And so this is just a different view of who we are, and it gives you a different perspective of what to pay attention, paying attention to the emotional realm, paying attention to all the unconscious signals that are going on. And it gives you a different perspective on all sorts of parts of who we are. And so, for example, when we think about human capital, what it takes to really lead a fulfilling life, we tend to think about the things we can count and measure, which are conscious and rational. We tend to think about IQ, about grades, about SAT scores, about professional skills. And all that is important. IQ explains about 25% of the variation in job performance. But 75% is not explained by these things. And this research gives you a venue into that realm. What's going on and what some of the economists call non-cognitive skills. And so it highlights that a series of traits that we're not good at measuring, but which are tremendously important. And so, for example, one of those traits, which is half unconscious, half conscious, half rational, half emotional, is what you might call mindsight. Do you have the ability to enter into other people and download the knowledge that they have inside their heads? Now, babies come with this ability. Alan Meltzoff in 1979, a researcher at the University of Washington, leaned over a baby who was 43 minutes old. He wagged his tongue at the baby, and the baby, 43 minutes old, wagged her tongue back. The baby doesn't know what a face is, doesn't know what she is, doesn't know what a tongue is, but they know they're supposed to mimic, and they know they're supposed to study faces in front of them, because that's how they download information. And so babies are phenomenally good at reading faces. If you take a bunch of six-month-olds, put a bunch of monkey faces in front of them, the six-month-olds can recognize one monkey from another because they're really good at looking at minute facial distinctions. We as adults don't need to do this, and we can't tell one monkey from another. Now, in this country, 55% of the babies by age 18 months have established a relationship with mom that allows them to download not only what mom is thinking and what mom knows, how she organizes her view of the world, but they also establish models of how to form relationships. So when they go to school, they know how to form a relationship with teacher, how to form a relationship with their peers. And if you can do that by 18 months or 54 months, you have a tremendous leg up all through life. And so researchers at the University of Minnesota found that they could take a look at what they call these attachment patterns at 18 months and predict with 77% accuracy who is going to graduate from high school. Because if you go in knowing how to relate, you'll have a big advantage. Now, in this country, about 20% of the kids have what they call avoidant attachment patterns. They're sending signals to mom, but for whatever reason, nothing is coming back. And these kids are at a disadvantage. So one of the teachers I read about described an avoidantly attached kid coming into the classroom like a sailboat tacking into the wind. wanting to get close to teacher, but not really knowing how to do it and ending up with his back to the teacher. Wanting to have established relationship, but don't knowing how to do it. These kids, avoidantly attached kids, later in life have less activation in the rewards area to their brain during social interaction. They get less of a kick out of friendship. By age 70, they're likely to have many, many fewer friends than other people. Now, nothing that happens at 18 months determines a life course, but pathways are opened up, skills are developed, which can either be confirmed or deconfirmed by later experience. And some people have this ability to just laser into you and to take all you have. I actually, a couple weeks ago, I was out in Los Angeles and I met a guy I'd never met named Michael Milken, who was famous for insider trading fame and for charitable donations since. And he's one of these people who just lasers into you. And in an hour, if you spend an hour with him, he's going to leave knowing everything you know. It's a sort of an intensity, but it's an important skill that people have. The second trait I'll call equipoise. And that is having the serenity and maturity to look inside your own mind and understanding your own shortcomings and unconscious biases. The scientists use a word, metacognition, the ability to think about your own thinking. So for example, we in this country are overconfidence machines. 95% of college professors in this country believe they have above average teaching skills. Time magazine asked Americans, are you in the top 1% of earners? 19% of Americans are in the top 1% of earners. And as an extra 36% expect to be someday. Two researchers, Paul Schumacher and Edward Russo, gave tests to executives about their own industries and then asked them, how confident are you got the answers right about on these tests? People in the advertising industry were pretty sure they got 90% of the answers correct. In fact, they got 60% of them wrong. The most overconfident industry was the computer industry, where the executives thought they got 95% of the answers correct. In fact, they got 80% wrong. This is a strongly gender-linked trait, by the way. And so men drown at twice the rate as women because men have tremendous confidence in their ability to swim after they've been drinking, and women do not. Now, the third trait after equipoise and mindsight is a Greek word, metis, the ability to look over a landscape and detect the important patterns and to discern the important patterns from the unimportant patterns. And so we might call it street smarts. And so, for example, my newspaper did a story about soldiers in Iraq who could look down a street and tell whether there was an IED, a landmine, in the street. And when you ask them, how do you know? They say, well, I couldn't really tell you, but I feel a coldness inside. And this ability to detect patterns and to know when something's right or wrong does not come intuitively full-born. It comes from hard experience and close observation. When you work hard at closely observing a certain field, then you change the way you see the field in ways you're not really aware of. And so, for example, one of the experiments, they took chess grandmasters and chess novices and asked them to memorize the chessboard in about 5 seconds. The chess grandmasters had no problem memorizing every piece on the board. The novices could get maybe 4 or 5 pieces. And that's because the chess grandmasters did not see pieces. They saw formations. It's the difference between seeing a story or a paragraph and trying to memorize the individual letters. And then they moved the chess pieces around so they were in a position that could never actually happen in a chess game. And in this circumstances, the chess grandmasters were no better than anybody else. And so it is the ability to see differently, to lay down in your own mind different models of how to perceive reality. Perception is not a simple process of taking in. It is an act of world creation. You are creatively organizing the world when you see the world. And so that is another important trait. The fourth trait I'll mention, just two more, is sympathy. If metis is the ability to see the patterns in a landscape, sympathy is the ability to discern the subtle intonations in other people, in a social environment. This comes in extremely handy at work. We tend to work better as groups than we do as individuals. Somebody had the bright idea of looking at the Olympic swimming scores, times, the last Olympics. They compared the times in the individual events versus the times those same swimmers racked up as part of relay teams. People swim a lot faster when they're in a relay team than they do as individuals. and the people late in the team, the third and fourth leg, swim especially faster than their own personal time because they feel indispensable to the group. And if you want to compensate people well in a company, don't reward individual effort with a compensation incentive. Form them into groups and reward the whole group when they do well. It's just much more powerful. And so groups are more powerful than individuals. Groups that meet face to face are more powerful than groups that meet any other way. And so at the University of Michigan, they took people at organized them in a group, gave some groups 10 minutes to solve a math problem, and let them meet face to face. They could solve the problems easily. Other groups had 30 minutes to solve the problems, but they had to communicate by email. And they could not solve the math problems. Those groups broke up. Because so much of our communication is by intonation of voice, is by gesture, by smell, by all these other things that we're often not aware of. But that's really the most important thing. And the intelligence of a group was not determined by the IQ of the individual members. It was determined by how often they took turns in conversation, how often they could read signals. And so this is a trait that some people have and some people don't. The fifth trait is propriety, the ability to scaffold your world, to structure your world in ways that maximize character and self-control. My favorite experiment in all these fields, probably the most famous experiment in all these fields, was conducted by a guy named Walter Mischel. It's called the Marshmallow Experiment. And many of you probably know this experiment, but just very briefly, Mischel took four-year-olds, put them in a room, put a marshmallow on the table in front of them, said to the kids, you can eat this marshmallow now, but I'm coming back in 10, 15, 20 minutes. If you haven't eaten the marshmallow, I'll give you two marshmallows. And you can go online and see the videos of the kids trying not to eat the marshmallows. There's a little girl banging her head on the table, trying not to eat the marshmallow. One day, Michelle was using an Oreo cookie. A little guy picked up the Oreo, carefully ate out the middle, and carefully put it back on the table. That kid is now a US senator. But 20 years later, the kids who could wait 8, 10, 12 minutes, much higher college completion rates, and much higher incomes. 30 years later, the kids who could pop it right in their mouth, they had much higher drug and alcohol addiction problems, and much higher incarceration rates. And that's because some kids grow up in homes where actions lead to consequences, and they develop strategies to control their impulses. And they don't do it by staring at the marshmallow and saying, I will exert iron willpower not to eat the thing. They have strategies to distract themselves. They turn around, they sing a song, they pretend the marshmallow is a cloud. And so this is the strategy to control themselves. And one of the themes of the research is that the way you change your mind, it's very hard to directly change your mind, the way you're thinking, because there's too much going on down there that you're not aware of. But the way you change your thinking is by changing your behavior. If you change your behavior by adopting etiquette, politeness, other little rules, then over time, through the repetition of habits, you will groove certain behaviors, certain ways of seeing. Change your behavior to change your mind, or as the folks at Alcoholics Anonymous put it, fake it till you make it. And so some people have the ability to structure their world in ways that allow them to exercise character and self-control. Some people don't. The final thing I'll mention is not so much a trait, but a motivation and a drive. And in the book, I use the word limerence. Now, what the conscious mind wants are the things the magazines write about. The conscious mind wants us to be famous and successful and rich and good-looking. But what the unconscious mind hungers for are those moments when self-awareness, when consciousness fades away, and we're lost in something larger than ourselves. When an athlete is just lost in the sport, when a carpenter or a craftsman is lost in the craft, when a naturalist feels at one with nature, when a religious believer feels enveloped by God's love, and while most of us feel lost in the love for one another. The unconscious is happiest at these moments when we're connected deeply with one another or with a task. Social connection is the strongest. Joining a club that meets once a month produces the same happiness gain as doubling your income. I tell college students, every course you take in college should be about who you're going to marry, because no other decision will be as important. So every course, you should read novels about marriage, you should read psychology about marriage, neuroscience about marriage, No one listens to me. Colleges don't offer these courses. But it's insane, because if you have a great marriage and a bad career, you'll be happy. If you have a great career and a bad marriage, you'll be unhappy. And yet we send kids off totally unprepared for this decision. And now this decision to fall in love is like a lot of the decisions I've been talking about. It's half conscious, half unconscious, half emotional, half rational. And so when we marry people, there's an unconscious logic to our choice. We tend to marry people with nose widths of similar width to our own. We tend to marry people with eyes similarly far apart. We tend to marry people with complementary immune systems to our own, so our kids will have a better immune system, and we tell that by saliva. We tend to marry people with as much status as we can get. And unfortunately for me, that means women tend to like taller guys, because every inch in height in this country corresponds to about $6,000 a year of annual income. Though I did see a great study by Dan Ari Elliott at Duke. He looked at online dating sites, and he found that a guy who's 5'6" can get as many online date offers from women as a guy who's 6', so long as he makes $172,000 a year more. And so there is a logic to our choices. But there's also, of course, more than just logic to the choice. There is an enchantment to it. In the book, I mention a great passage by Stendhal, a French writer, who uses the phrase crystallization. And he describes salt miners, I think in Austria, who threw branches into a mine. They'd come back weeks later, and they'd hold up the branches, and they'd be covered in crystals. And when they held up to the light, they would shimmer beautifully in the light. And he said, this is what we do to our beloved. We endow them with crystals, with beautiful crystals, so they appear more beautiful to us than perhaps they are. And this is part of the enchantment of the emotional process. And so as I was doing the research, I came across a passage which encapsulates a lot of the themes I've been talking about here. The power of unconscious connection, the power of emotion to organize our thinking, and the power of interpenetration of people. And it was in a book by a great scientist who's at Indiana University in Bloomington named Douglas Hofstadter, who's written a whole series of very fine books. And in one of his books called I Am a Strange Loop, he describes a personal episode from his life. He had written many fine books, and he got a sabbatical, I think, to Italy. And he's over there with his wife, named Carol, and their kids, who were at that point age 5 and 2. And while they were over there, Carol very suddenly and very shockingly suffered a stroke and died when their kids were at that young age. And Hofstadter had a picture, a photograph of Carol on the bureau of his bedroom. And I'm sure he probably saw that photograph constantly in the course of his normal days. But one day, several months after she had died, he looked at it with particular attention. And here's what Hofstadter wrote in his book, I Am a Strange Loop. I looked at her face, and I looked so deeply that I felt I was behind her eyes. And all at once, I found myself saying, as tears flowed, that's me, that's me. And those simple words brought back many thoughts that I had had before about the fusion of our souls into one higher level entity, about the fact that the core of both our souls lay our identical hopes and dreams for our children, about the notion that those hopes were not separate or distinct hopes, but were just one hope, one clear thing that had defined us both, that welded us into a unit, the kind of unit I had but dimly imagined before being married and having children. I realized that though Carol had died, that core piece of her had not died at all, but that it had lived on very determinedly in my brain. And so the Greeks used to say we suffer our way to wisdom, and the wisdom that Hofstadter suffered his way to was the wisdom that we are deeply interpenetrated one with another. The loops that surge through our minds are shared loops. They come from the people we know. They come from the educational system. They come from our families. They come from our cultures. They come from deep in our historical past, relayed through teachings and through genes, and that we are deeply connected. And I think in a less tragic and a less shallow, a less important way maybe, we through our policy failures have come to the wisdom that if we have policies based on an insufficient view of human nature, then those policies will be disappointing. If we raise our kids based on an inarticulateness about what's really important, our child-rearing techniques will be insufficient. And if we try to have moral discussions based on an insufficient understanding of where morality comes from. Those discussions will be insufficient. And the good news is that we're living at this time of incredible advance in these fields of studying the mind. And when Freud wrote about the unconscious many decades ago, it had a pervasive effect on the culture. Now I think researchers are giving us a more accurate view of the unconscious, and I think it will have a pervasive and extremely positive view on our culture and our policy for decades to come. So thank you very much.
David, let me kick off by reminding you that several years ago you wrote in the Times that you were optimistic about the social stability of the United States, and you said that you thought it was in the middle of an amazing moment of improvement and repair. Now, with the deep disagreements that we've got now about the role of government, the size and strength of the social safety net, the income divides not getting any better, and issues like gay marriage. Do you think we're now more or less stable as a society than we were 5 or 7 years ago?
I think we're more stable as a society and less stable as a polity. And so I have a friend who worked in the Clinton administration, then went up to New York schools to help with the New York schools. And he sent me an email several months ago, and he said, I've never been so optimistic about education reform, and I've never been so pessimistic about government. And that's about where I am. I'm remain optimistic about the culture of America, in part because of people under 30. It's an incredibly wholesome and responsible generation. You know, if you look at teenage pregnancy rates down by a third, teenage violence is down, teenage suicide is down, crime is down, divorce rates are down. We're in an incredible period of social repair because of the hardworking, really community-oriented people under 30 and 40. I think they're all going to have the biggest midlife crisis in human history in about 10 years. But until that, they're really impressive. And then the second thing, the strengths we have as a society are the strengths we've always had. Alexis de Tocqueville came here in the 1830s, described certain American traits which are still here. And so we are the only big nation on Earth that is really good at welcoming and magnifying the talents of outsiders. And so people from all around the world can come here, go to Silicon Valley, go here, and their talents will be magnified and they will be accepted. That is something China will never do very well. And so I'm tremendously hopeful about that. Our politics, though, goes from worse to worse. And so, you know, I think the central challenge we face right now is the fiscal crisis, that we're running up this debt, which will make government unaffordable within 5 or 6 or 7 years, and will lead to a financial crack-up within a few years, I don't know when, but at some point. And as I cover the politicians in dealing with them, people I generally admire, I find them not even talking to each other, avoiding the tough choices that actually need to be made, and when they see the other party making some of those choices, taking advantage of it. You know, I'm really a big admirer of both Paul Ryan and Barack Obama. It disturbs me that they've never actually met, that Obama had never called Ryan and said, let's have lunch, let's talk about this. And that makes it impossible to actually cut a sort of Simpson-Bowles type deal, which is what we need to do. And we need to have that sort of bipartisan arrangement at the top, because right now the country is simply unwilling to pay for the government it demands. And we need a bipartisan education program at the top to educate the country about what's going to be required, and to ask for common sacrifice where everybody takes a hit. And we don't have that kind of leadership to ask for those sorts of things and to do that sort of education campaign. So I think we're on the downward spiral to some large financial crack-up. How's that for cheerful?
Each time I hear a news item or listen to analysis of what's going on in our world today, primarily, I must say, on Capitol Hill as well as other places, what goes through my mind, particularly if I'm listening to you, is the question, are we now seeing Bobos in paradise? And I'd like your reaction.
I'd written this book about people with 60s values and 90s money, and 2000s, and I will say there was a desire there to have one's cake and eat it too. And so I, as I say, I'm generally, I think we're in a period of cultural repair. I think American society is in many ways in better shape than ever before. But the one thing I think we face, a problem we face as a society, is it's hard to express, but the expansion of self. And let me tell it very quickly in a 1 minute story. I was listening to NPR in Washington one Sunday night, and I heard an old broadcast of a show called Command Performance. And this was a variety show that went out to the troops in World War II. And the show episode I heard was broadcast on VJ Day, 1945, live. Bing Crosby gets out there, is the host of the show, and says, just hours ago, we've learned that the Japanese are gonna surrender. And, but I guess we don't feel too proud, we just feel modest, we're just glad we got through it. And this tone of incredible modesty at this incredible moment in American history was repeated throughout the show. And then I park and I get in my house and I turn on a football game, and a quarterback throws a pass, a wide receiver catches it and is tackled after a 2 yard gain. And the defensive player does what all professional athletes do and after great achievements, which is to do a dance in celebration of himself. And it occurred to me I'd seen more self-puffery after a 2 yard gain than I just heard America after winning World War II. And this is not only me being nostalgic for a time when I didn't exist, but there are actually statistical evidence to show we've gotten more happy, more pleased with ourselves. So in 1950, the Gallup organization asked high school seniors, are you a very important person? 12% said yes. They asked them again in 2005, 80% said yes. And so that's just a shift. If you look at our educational performance, Americans are now about 37th in the world in math performance. If you ask us, are we good at math, we are number one in the world in thinking we're good at math. And so this magnification of self has led to increased spending and debt as we try to spend in ways that befit our station. But it's also led to a lessened sense of common purpose, that we as individuals are just a small part of a large national enterprise. I think it's led to less respect for institutions and less of a feeling of citizenship. And so every generation has a tendency, an incentive to spend on themselves and pass the cost to future generations. No generation until ours did it because they had a visceral horror at the thought that they would soil that chain of generations. And so for all the great things that are happening in the country, I do think the magnification of ego is a problem. And I sort of describe in that book, but it's become more clear to me since.
Well, I was following up on what you just said. I'm a psychologist, and I've been studying people in community, and particularly with couples, how we need community. And if, in fact, it is, as you're saying, an unconscious need or even drive to be connected, how do you explain? I know the ego is part of it, but it seems like, an even more profound drive towards individualism and even narcissism in our society. How do you explain that, given what you just described to us about this need and natural drive towards connection?
Yeah, well, we've had two individualist... I mean, culture really matters. Culture matters a lot. The experiments I quote in the book on the importance of culture, they took a bunch of people with and watched them have coffee in different parts of the world, and then measured how much the people having coffee reached across the table and touched each other just for affection. And I'm gonna get the numbers wrong, but you get the proportion. In Rio, I think it was 180 touches an hour. In Paris, it was 120 touches an hour. And in London, it was 0 touches an hour. So culture matters, and our culture shifted. And I think we had two revolutions that were both individualistic in nature. One in the 1960s, which we would call a left-wing individualism, which was a revolt against conformity and an expansion of individual freedom in the social sphere to create your own morals, to create your own religions, not to defer to authority. And then in the 1980s, what you would call a conservative revolution was individual liberation in the economic sphere. And so we've had two different movements, both of which liberated the individual. And we've done a good job of liberating the individual and emphasizing freedom. But in the course of that, I think we've underplayed civility and connection. And there's now a range of happiness research, and it's somewhat serious. And if you take two movies as as sort of two different models of how to be happy. One is say on the road, where you get off on a motorcycle and you ride across the country by yourself. I'm now forgetting the exact movie, a Jack Nicholson movie, but he's off on a motorcycle. So that's one model. You want individual freedom to be happy. The other is it's a wonderful life. You want neighborhood connections to be happy. Well, the evidence is unequivocal. It's a wonderful life is right. That's the surest way to be happy. But we've underplayed those citizen connections, I think because of cultural changes.
Thank you for your talk. I was hoping you might be able to put your policy cap back on for a moment. If you were to take the constellation of information that you've presented today and some of the lessons that you've learned from writing this book, how do you think you might implement some of this in our educational policies, perhaps at the elementary or secondary level?
Yeah. Well, I think what you need is you have to have a diet of human capital. We have to have a second generation of human capital policies. We've done a good job of getting people into high school and into college. We've done a lousy job of getting them through. So college completion rates have been flat for a generation. And that's in part because they're not academically prepared for college, in part for financial reasons, but mostly because of these emotional and social deficits, the things I really emphasized. And so I would start at birth with nurse-family partnerships to coach moms to give them lessons on how to be better moms. I would have intensive early childhood education. Nothing we can do can have as big a payoff as that. I would have a pretty rigorous effort to reform Head Start, which is a good program that doesn't work nearly well enough as it should. And then I would have a whole series of reforms that give teachers more opportunity to establish personal relationships with students. One of the programs I talk about in the book are these great programs many of you know, probably called KIPP Academies, which they do the math and the reading and they do the accountability, but they also do all the social skills that are important. So they spend hours teaching kids how to walk down the hallway, how to nod in agreement, how to look people in the eye, how to see their own lives in a future context. And so when your class year at KIPP Academy is not the year you're going to graduate from high school, it's the year 4 years hence where they expect you to graduate from college. To put it in your mind, I am a college student. I'm going to go to college. And so those things are actually more important or as important as the reading and math. And we have educational systems based on the idea that brains are this empty vessels that we're going to download knowledge into. And we sometimes ignore all the other stuff. And especially for kids down the income stream, that becomes much more important.
Thank you so much. One of the first things I'm going to do is buy that book. You explained something that has been a mystery to me when you were talking about the man whose wife died and how the two had become one. Because that actually happened to me with my late husband. I developed a skill that he had that I did not have. And after he died, I had it. It was amazing. So that was a truly important learning for me with what you said. I'm really concerned with the children because mothers are not home these days. And how can we solve that and still have women who are, you know, choosing their careers? How can we have this happen? Because it requires so much work to be a parent, and certainly a huge amount to be a wife and to be a husband.
Yeah. Well, I guess the first thing I'd say is I actually think there's a lot of social inequality in a lot of this. But say among the classic upper middle class families or middle class families where you've got two families or two parents working. I think what's happened over the last decades is kind of remarkable in that the number of hours in the workforce, especially for women, has gone up. But the number of hours spent with kids has not gone down. And so even though people are entering the workforce, they're still devoting an enormous amount of time to child rearing. What's being lost are things like friendships. A lot of adults of child rearing age are spending less time with friends, less time out on the golf course, less time on their own personal happiness. And so one of the things that happened, well, in the first year of life, the average mom loses 700 hours of sleep time. The average marital satisfaction drops by 70%. And so there's this U-shaped curve in happiness. So people in their 20s are happy, people in their 30s and 40s less happy, and then it peaks again. It goes at its highest level the first 10 or 15 years after retirement. And so there's a lot of stress as people are raising their kids because there's so much sacrifice to make sure time is spent with those kids. And so I'm not totally concerned about it. The other thing to say, and this is something Turkheimer here emphasizes, you don't need to be super mom and dad. All the Mozart for babies' minds, all the Mandarin flashcards, that really doesn't get you much. You just need to be good enough. You just need to establish a relationship with the kids so they can feel someone is listening to them, and when they talk, somebody's going to attune to them. You just need to be good enough. And so as long as parents are there to establish a relationship, then they can do that. Our problem is not at the middle class level. Our problem is the very disorganized parts of society where kids are being strapped into car seats and watching TV 8 hours a day, where mom's putting Coke in the bottle just to get the kid quiet because they're under so much stress. That's where the real problems are.
Thank you very much. From the point of view of a psychiatric social worker, I want to congratulate you on using your Trump card in your today's column.
That was about Donald
now,
Trump.
Your book drove me to go back to 1798 to the model of Malthus. I was wondering what you thought of the limerence between Malthus' concept, his mindset, and the population of the earth today. Number two, you've mentioned three or four professors here at the University of Virginia. I wondered if you heard of Dr. Vamik Valkin, who has thought very much the same way you have as a neo-Freudian and is now nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize and has a lot of support from professionals all around the world.
Hmm. Well, two things. First, on Malthus, I confess I'm not a scholar of Malthus. My half-formed prejudice about it, I've never read him, so if I were an academic, I wouldn't venture any opinion, but hey, I'm not, so what the hell? The one thing everyone knows about Malthus is the prediction of that of starvation. But one of the things we should always be skeptical of is materialistic explanations of how we behave and who we are. Because I'm a big believer in Daniel Patrick Moynihan's phrase that the central conservative truth is that culture matters most, and the central liberal truth is that government can change culture. So when I want to look whether a country is going to be able to support a rising population, don't tell me about the material environment of that culture. That I don't think that tells you much. Tell me about the institutions in that culture and the child-rearing techniques in that culture. So I really focus on the spiritual and cultural things, less the material things, and wanting to know which societies can be rich, which self-sustaining, which growing, and which declining. And then as to Dr. Valkin, I confess there are a million people I don't know about. Who are in this field. One of the things you learn is about how, if you go to the neuroscience convention, there are like 40,000 people there. And that's just one field in a range of different fields. And so the range of people doing this work is truly impressive. And then the final thing they'll said, and I guess we're out of time, so I'll just wrap up on this, is that there are all these scientists doing this work, but one of the things the best of them are really convinced of is that people who came hundreds of years ago, whether it's Aristotle or Hume or George Eliot or Jane Austen, they were observing the things that we're now confirming with science. And that they're tremendously impressed with what Aristotle knew about us, which we now have multi-million dollar machines to confirm. But they got it just by observation. And the second and the final thing to be emphasized is that just because we say something is unconscious and something is emotional does not mean it's beyond our ability to control. We have the power to educate of our emotions by putting ourselves in the right environment and by studying art and music and literature. When you move with a Jane Austen character or a Tolstoy character, you are replicating what that character is going through in your own head. You're leaving residue which widens the repertoire of your emotional perceptions. And so that's one of the reasons it's important to go to the University of Virginia and study English and literature and history. And it may be even a reason to go to the Miller Center from time to time. So thank you very much.